This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 270 for not Wednesday, but Saturday, April 21st, 2018. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into when I am not down and out with a sinus cold. So if you're wondering why we're recording late, that is why. Also why I sound like I have a sinus cold. It's been my personal hell for the last week. But joining me tonight, I guess it is tonight. It's weird because it's still sunny outside. Alistair McFly at ohmyzod.com and iMcFly on Twitter. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me back.
Hey, it's sorry for all the rigmarole the last couple of days of trying to schedule and reschedule. We had it all set up for Wednesday night and it's gonna work, but I find, as I'm sure most people realize when you have a cold, the later in the day it gets, the worse you tend to feel. So recording podcasts late at night is like a nope, I just can't. I think the show would suffer. So I decided to just kind of give myself a couple of days. I was actually a little bit concerned that we were going to miss this week, but I think I'm going to be able to get this out and up on the Patreon page in no time. So yeah, but it's been a little while since I've had you on the show, man. What's been going on?
To be honest, not that much. I managed to get my website actually up and running again.
Oh, nice.
So there's actually new content on there, finally, after all this time.
Have you been on since you revamped the coming soon stuff?
I have not, no.
Okay, is it front and center on ohmyzod.com, or is there a special
section? It's kind of in the page menu, but okay. If you go to ohmyzod.com/soon, there's basically a list of movies that are coming out and TV shows that I'm interested in as well. So just with the immense number of things coming out, I mean, it kind of has, I think, the next 4 years covered. As long as there's been a release date for something, I've got it on there.
Nice. For anybody that's listening, it all kind of falls in the realm of like sci-fi, fantasy, or the like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, lots of superhero stuff on there.
Yeah, cartoons and animated stuff is also there. I know that you had some Disney releases and things like that. Basically, all the kind of stuff that we generally talk about on this little cafe, which is why I bring it up, because it's a great resource to be like, hey, when is that coming out? You know, I had to be reminded today when I watched an interview on YouTube with Tom Holland that the Avengers opens up in less than a week. It's Thursday.
Mm. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I have my tickets already and it's so bizarre. I was actually at the cinema last night watching Super Troopers 2.
Okay.
And they had a commercial, trailer. They had a movie trailer at the beginning for Ant-Man and the Wasp. And as it started out, I was like, okay, because I've tried to avoid the trailers for the Avengers. And it starts out, I'm like, this is an Avengers one. Then I realized this is all Ant-Man and being reminded that there's Ant-Man and the Wasp and suddenly thinking that's going to be the first Marvel film after the Infinity Wars thing. And just thinking like there's going to be Infinity War. Then there's going to be Ant-Man and the Wasp. You know, there's a couple of other, and then we're into essentially the second part, the continuation from Infinity War. But it's going to be weird having that, like, the next couple kind of in the middle. And just thinking, like, we've got this big thing that's, like, the big epic that everything's been leading to.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we're Ant-Man and the Wasp, which I'm wholeheartedly looking forward to.
Oh, me too. Do you know the timeline? Like, not in real life, but in the movie. Is the Ant-Man and the Wasp film happening in events set before Infinity War or after?
I would imagine it's after because everything's... Well, I say everything... Obviously not with the Captain America stuff.
Right.
But for the most part, a lot of it tends to be chronological. And I think just the way that they're doing the films now, I think it would be weird for them to set something that's set present day, but set before Infinity War.
Right. Because you'd be talking about
without
like
releasing it before.
A backtracking of, you know, a couple of months, right? Like not, as opposed to, you know, or a year at most, like, but not getting into stuff like that. Interesting. Because it would be cool to see some of the aftermath, you know, like some of the, you know, because we don't know what's going to happen. And it would be kind of cool to see what happens to these other characters.
Especially as the more minor ones kind of drop, they sort of step back into their own lives again. It's like, we're done, let's go home.
I'm not necessarily worried about Infinity War, but so far, some of the interviews that I've seen, I've been avoiding more trailers and TV spots and stuff because I don't want to get any eye candy shot at me that is would be better first experienced in the theater. I have enjoyed some of the interviews with the cast because they are tight-lipped. Like, they don't say anything. Half the time, I don't even think they're fibbing. I think they're like, no, I haven't read the whole script. Like, half the time I was acting with a green ball and a stick. Like, that's supposed to be, Benedict Cumberbatch in the next scene. Like, so, because he's floating or flying or, like, some special effect is happening and stuff like that. So, I don't necessarily think that they're being super coy about not knowing what's going on. I really think that a movie of this scale, with the schedules for all of those actors, there's no way you could get them all in the room at the same time.
And then you've also got like Tom Holland, who's renowned for leaking stuff that they don't even allow him to know most of his own things.
That was part of the joke, is that Graham Norton was asking Tom Holland all these questions and Tom's like, I really don't know. Okay. And he seemed like really, really sincere. He's like, yeah, I have no idea. He's like, you've got a new suit. Like, is that metal? He's like, no, I have no clue. Because, and one of the cool things that he let slip in the interview, which isn't a spoiler, it was, I didn't actually get a costume. He's like, I'm standing next to some of these other heroes. He doesn't say who. He just says, and they're in their costume physically on set. You know, it's like $100,000 of like the top costume makers. And I'm in a leotard with like little glowing dots on it. Because I guess they have to put his suit on in most cases because it does so many things, right? Because you've seen it in the trailer that it's got a lot of metal bits to it. It's a suit that Tony Stark gave him. So it's got a lot of moving parts, which are obviously not practical for physical suits. So his suit is a lot of CG. So he's like, it was kind of like, everybody's looking like amazing on set and I'm in my pajamas. It's a fun interview, actually. He's a really charismatic kid. I have to give him that.
Mm.
I can't remember. Do you know how old he is in real life?
I don't. I know it's not really far off the character's
age. No,
he's not like the other two who've been playing like 5 years younger than their actual age.
No, I think Tom Holland is. If he's 21, I'd be very surprised. He's playing a 15 or 16 year old, but I would be very, very surprised if he's 1996. So I was right. He's 22.
Oh wow! So that actually is a little bit longer than. He is actually a little bit older than I thought he was.
He's a small guy, so I can kind of see him being played a little bit younger.
He's a believable teenager.
Yeah. Well,
you can actually believe him as a teenager.
He's 22 now, but when he made Civil War, he would have been much younger.
That explains it.
Right.
That
so he would have been 17 or 18 at most, right? Because that movie's a couple years old. They probably would have filmed it a couple years before that. So I'd have to do some Google math on that. But I would say he was probably still a teenager when he first put on the Spider-Man suit.
Time is cruel to my memory.
Join the club. Anyway, speaking of all this cool sci-fi stuff and what's new, both you and I have had the opportunity to watch the entirety of Lost in Space on Netflix. Mm-hmm. So we thought it would be fun to talk about on the show. We will eventually get into some spoilers, folks. So if you have not completed Lost in Space, then we'll give you another heads up as to when to tune out. But because it's new, it's only been out a week, I wanted to talk about it on the show because very rarely do I dive onto something right when it comes out and finish it really quickly in a way that I can talk about it on the Citadel Cafe. Like you and I were both finished before Wednesday last week and it only came out on Friday. So
yeah, I was done in like 2 days.
Yeah. I tried not to be, I could have easily finished it in a couple of days. My dad did. So if you're wondering what it's like to be retired, that you can do that. You can just watch an entire season of Netflix in a day.
This is the odd thing for me, right? Is that it's been so long since I've had a show that I've done that with. My friend Chris actually sent me an image that he found online, which was how to watch a movie in 2018. And it's like five simple steps. And it's like you open Netflix, you click through 500 films, you select a TV series, you pick an episode you've seen, and you look at your phone for 45 minutes. Yeah. This is how I've watched and rewatched so much Star Trek.
Yeah.
Because I don't tend to pick up new series that much. And even when I do, I'll give them, say, five episodes. And I'm just finding that, especially on Netflix, aside from the ones that I'm already invested in, I'm not finding myself drawn into kind of go through a marathon something. But with Lost in Space, I just couldn't stop.
I agree, and I think it's in part due to the writing. Little cliffhangers at the end of each episode, that sort of stuff. But also, they just do a really good job immersing you in this world that they've created. And it's far-fetched, but it's not so far-fetched. Like, they base quite a lot of it in reality, which I really liked. In terms of just the visuals. Like, I mean, you're on a forested planet with oxygen and ice and water and things. The composition of all that is up for grabs, but like the look and feel is alien but familiar. So you don't really have to suspend a lot of disbelief. So if it hits closer to home, like it's less crazy science fiction, I find. And at least when you first get into it, and more of the kind of things you'd get from like a Michael Crichton book. You know, like Jurassic Park is sci-fi, but it's not set 200 years in the future. It's like 50, you know, like it's within a generational reach. Go ahead.
Yeah, I really love as well how they've drawn from the original series and the 1998 movie and how they've developed everything from there.
So I didn't see either of those.
Really?
So okay. my Lost in Space experience, I might have seen that movie in the 90s, but not all of it, I don't think, or like it might have been on TV or something, because I don't recall it. Like I don't really remember anything from it, other than maybe not liking it. And I know I've not seen any of the original TV series, but it's really old. Like it's like 60s, I think.
It's like 1965 is when it all started.
Yeah, that kind of stuff, it's not usually my thing. I know about Lost in Space from pop culture, like sci-fi jokes and references and comics and like that kind of thing, but never just like a firsthand experience.
Well, we had over in the UK, the BBC was very up on showing a lot of the Irwin Allen stuff, so you had Lost in Space, you had Time Tunnel, you had Land of the Giants. You know, so all of these kind of classic 60s American sci-fi. And I grew up watching quite a lot of that. And it's the original series, it was all basically based on the Swiss Family Robinson. So the idea of just, and they even keep the same names, right?
Yep. Got that vibe.
Yeah. So family shipwrecked. And the movie really kind of kept a lot of what was in the pilot for that and kind of expanded upon it. Well, say kept a lot of it, like the first half of the movie kind of sets out about the same. Mm-hmm. And I really do prefer the 80s movie, 98 movie, sorry, which has Matt LeBlanc in there. But for the new TV series, they basically stripped all of it apart and just rebuilt it. And I think I mentioned it in the Discord chat that they did it in a similar way to how Battlestar Galactica was done.
Yes.
Where they took everything from the original series, you know, stripped it apart and then put everything back and reassembled it in a completely new way.
And in a way that speaks to today's audiences, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, you've got the idea of in the 60s, you've got this perfect family. You've got the mother and the father, the three kids, you know, they're all this happy family. They're all incredibly smart. But this family in the new Netflix series is a much more modern interpretation where you've got one of the kids is from a previous marriage. Mm-hmm. The parents are separated, you know, and the kids have all been living with the mother and they're all having to leave the planet to to go to Alpha Centauri, and he doesn't want to be separated from his kids. He wants to go with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a lot more real in terms of how modern families are today.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of relatable relationships, pardon the terrible way of expressing that, but like parents that have been through divorces would identify with the parents, you know, kids that have parents that are divorced are going to identify with the kids and missing one parent or the other. And, or like, you know, that awkward moment when you're seeing the parents fight and the kids are kind of like trying to find something to do, even though they want to sit there and listen. Right. You know, there's a lot of like really subtle moments like that. On a grand scale, I really like the way that they set things up in that, they give you a lot of suspense, a lot of what's going to happen next, and they don't explain everything right away. Like, you really have to get about 4 episodes into the series, which is not hard, before you start to understand why they left Earth, how they got where they are, what happened, and really get a feel for the relationships, the dynamics that are available to you between mom, dad, kids, and then other characters. And it takes that long, but you are still always given a tidbit every episode, some more than others. Like, one episode might focus more on the parents versus, you know, one episode might focus more on, say, like Will Robinson or something. But you still always get tidbits from around the table. And it's so much intrigue in that you're not necessarily watching the next episode to find out, uh-oh, I wonder what's going to happen and how they get out of this, because you're on episode 3, there's 10 episodes, you know that obviously, you know, the cast probably sticks around. Like, I mean, in your head at that point, you're like, well, I'm not worried because I'm only in the 3rd episode. But what you really want to get is like, I want to know why mom and dad are angry at each other. I want to know why the eldest daughter is so ahead of her time in education. Like, she's a med student, but she's 18 or something like that. Like, the kind of thing that would normally be grad school stuff in our current world, where people are more in their mid-20s, she's doing it at like 17, 18, and has already done it before they left the planet, right? So there's all these things that you're just curious about, and it's all character information that you're salivating for, not necessarily the overall plot. That tends to pick up later on in the series. But in the first 4 episodes, I really think it's an excellent card to play to say, like, okay, they're stranded on a planet. That's the what, right? But it's the who that keeps you coming back episode after episode.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Absolutely. I mean, the dynamics between them, especially when you get Will talking to the robot,
mm-hmm.
and just trying to figure out that dynamic as well.
Yeah.
You know, even things like that is just fascinating to me.
Yeah. And I think they really knocked it out of the park, in terms of just the mood for the visuals and the music. I had someone, I think it was somebody on Facebook, one of my posts that was like an Instagram to Facebook transfer had said, like, you know, did you catch the little trip of the Harry Potter theme in one of the episodes? I was like, I think that might have been accidental, but it would make sense because the original Lost in Space theme was written by John Williams. So to have that kind of, because you get that feeling, like, before you even get the Netflix open, which you don't get in the first episode or the second,
it's episode 3.
Yeah. So it's 2 cold opens for episode 1 and 2. They throw you right into it. And then on episode 3, you get to watch a Netflix original series, Lost in Space. And they have all these images go by. Actually reminds me of the intro to Enterprise a little bit.
Yes. I was going to say the exact same thing. It's very much in the same vein where it's kind of showing a history of space flight
and exploration and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And then they get into like with the future and the Robinsons and all that kind of stuff. And, but the music is just wonderful. Like it's upbeat. It's very triumphant. Like it has that kind of like, next level aspect to it. And so I was not surprised at all when I realized that it was John Williams that composed the original theme. And I had thought I had written it down, but I'm blanking on the name of the composer that did the music for the Netflix series, but he knocks it out of the park.
It's Christopher something.
Yes, you're right. And I have IMDb open, but of course I list all the cast members first.
Christopher Lennertz.
Yes.
I'm just looking at my music collection because I have the soundtrack myself.
Oh, nice. It's phenomenal.
I'm tripping over my words now. but I cannot express how much joy I felt as soon as the end credits appeared for the first time and were given a modern rendition of the original theme.
Mm-hmm.
It just filled me with so much joy because it's such a happy theme for it as well.
Yeah.
It was almost chilling.
Yeah. No, they do a really good job of just enough nods, I think, to what, I mean, I'd never watched the original series, but like what I perceive from pop culture as like, you know, Danger Will Robinson and all that kind of stuff. Mm. Like, I get the idea that robot kind of says it a lot in the old series. Whereas in this particular series, the robot really doesn't speak a whole lot. When he does, it's poignant, but most of it is just kind of like this unspoken communication between Will and the robot, which is good because like, I don't necessarily need like a robotic voice coming over, you know, this, you know, robot every time he was to say something. The only thing that I would have preferred instead, I think, would have been actually the other way. Like, they went silent. I think that worked. If they had gone any other way, they would have to go completely 180 and go a talking robot. Like, actually have it talk. Not necessarily like Data from Star Trek, but like at least have a vocabulary.
Fully conversational.
Yeah, and I think... I can't tell you whether that would be better or worse, but they had to make a choice, but I think between those two, I don't think they could just have this Danger Will Robinson thing happen like all the time, because it would get old.
Yeah. And I think it also kind of works as an artificial intelligence thing in that it only communicates verbally when it needs to. And that kind of goes back to, you know, the Terminator,
right?
That you've got this machine that's going around and he will communicate and say things when he needs. I mean, Arnie's lines in the first movie were tiny. Like, he only had a few.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt that a lot from this, especially as it's not a man-made robot.
Right. Yeah. And it also amps up the mistrust / fear factor.
Mm.
Right? Because, I mean, you don't really get a feel for the robot's character. Right. Like when you're first watching the show,
no.
Like when you first get into it, there's no real character to the robot. It's very much a thing, a tool, a prop, you know, it's something that's following Will around and you don't really understand much about it. Which I think, again, it's that, and that adds to the, you know, just watch one more, got to find out one more thing, later on.
Yeah. And in the original series, I mean, the robot was, it came with the ship.
Yeah, it was theirs, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it was made by the government who built the ships, and so it's basically just a utility on board the ship.
Yeah.
This is a robot that they discover, and so there's an element of trust there, and can you trust it? What's its motivation? And, you know, is it safe to be around? And even... you know, even the family, the rest of the family are like, can we leave Will with this machine that we know nothing about? Or its origins? Is this safe?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. In the original series, how did they end up getting lost in space?
So they had Dr. Smith go on board, and he was... He ended up sabotaging the ship. And this is actually the exact same for the movie as well. They use the same plot for it. So Dr. Smith comes on board. He sabotages the ship, but he doesn't manage to get off in time. His entire purpose is to try and destroy the ship into the mission by programming the robot to destroy the ship and kill the Robinsons.
Oh, okay.
But what
was his motivation to do that, though?
In the original series, I can't remember. He was basically hired... in both of them, he was hired by a different organization to do it. I think in the original series, he was hired by another country. It was a space faction.
Right, so it's more of a political race to stop the Robinsons from being the first settlers of Alpha Centauri, to sort of thing.
Yeah, they're just they're trying to just stop that from happening.
Right.
So he programs the robot to destroy everything. He doesn't get off the ship in time, and so the robot starts to destroy stuff. In the original series, his weight added to the weight of the ship, which knocked them off course into an asteroid field, and the ship starts getting attacked by asteroids and then gets attacked by the robot. In the movie, it's just the robot does so much catastrophic damage that in both cases, he has to wake up the crew. And he has to wake up the Robinsons because he can't stop it on his own.
Right.
And then that's how they kind of get lost there. In the movie as well, they end up jumping to hyperspace, but they don't have an exit portal. So it's one of those... If we jump, we could end up anywhere in the universe, but they're about to be ripped apart by a sun. So
right. So yeah,
you know,
better to be lost in space than dead. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Cool. Well, because the way that they—I mean, we'll get to it a little bit later—but the way that they handled that kind of stuff, I think, in this series, I thought was really interesting. Because they do eventually tell you why, but they don't tell you why right away. And again, you know, just to not to repeat myself, but it does kind of keep you going, watching back and forth. Some of the criticisms that I've seen online through some Twitter conversations here and there, were people that were tuning out like really early on, like people that were watching the first episode and going, oh God, this is terrible. I mean, I was like, what? How? Like, I watched this and I could not wait to watch episode two. How did you think it was terrible? And I thought a lot of people were coming, like people were talking about the science being incorrect.
I saw a lot of that as well.
Yeah. So like this is the first 15 minutes, so it's not a spoiler, but they crash land on a planet and they're in a glacier and the ship sinks in the water and there's a lot of freezing and thawing going on because of the heat from the ship and then the temperature in the planet is dropping and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, people are injured from the crash. So there's all these things that have to happen. So they're trying to prioritize what they have to do in order to survive the night because it's going to drop to something like 60 below zero. And some of the water freezes really, really quickly. And my friend John was like, water doesn't freeze like that. I'm out. I'm just like, really? That's the one thing that pulls you out of this is that the water isn't freezing the right way on an alien planet that you don't know anything about. And my dad actually had another comment. He was like, you know, they're talking about how cold it is, how dangerous it is, and how they have to survive. And they're trying to dig this girl out of ice that's flash frozen, yet none of them are wearing gloves or hats. You know, like their skin is exposed. You know, so generally if ice is freezing that quickly, like your eyelids are going to freeze. Like that was the feedback that I was getting online. And my response was like, well, sure. But I mean, how cumbersome would it have been to have the first episode for its entirety to have all of the Robinsons in spacesuits talking through glass helmets? Like you really wouldn't feel much for them. It would be really difficult for the actors. So I think they made some concessions there for characters to really pull you in. And I didn't even really notice it. I thought about it after. Mm. Like when my dad pointed out the hat thing, I was like, yeah, you know, that makes sense. They really could have had thermal gear. Like they could have put on like hats or mitts or hoods or, you know, some sort of thing that looked like a tech warming suit or like there could have been something there, I think, to maybe push that back a little bit. But I didn't notice / forgave it quite quickly because of the interaction with the characters. How did you feel about the pseudoscience that was happening early on?
I didn't mind it. I mean, it's one of those things where it's kind of noticeable to some degree, but there's always a balance that you have to strike because if you make it I would argue that in a movie you could get away with more accurate science because you don't have as much time to deal with. So like Interstellar, they try to get into scientific theory as accurately as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a TV series, you have to get a balance between entertainment and fact. I mean, if you take Star Trek, for example, Star Trek's renowned for being a pretty scientifically accurate show to a degree.
Yeah.
You know, so when you're talking about faster than light travel, what that would be like, you know, transporter technology, you know, they leave a few gaps out, but they're like the theory behind it has some science to it and is sound.
Yeah.
But then you've got the fact that every alien is humanoid. They're all about the same height. They all breathe oxygen.
Yeah.
Their planets are completely safe to beam down to.
Yeah.
And you're not going to die from infections the moment you come into contact with them. You have to have some suspense to really warrant it. And that's going to be the same for any show set in space.
Yeah, well, there's really, it's called science fiction for a reason. there has to be some element of that in there.
Yeah. As long as they set up their own rules and they stick by their rules, I think that's where it's fine. When they start to contradict their own rules, that's when I have a problem with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just think about how boring Star Wars would be with no sound in space.
Mm.
Like, It can be handled really well. I mean, Firefly, there's no sound in space. It's used in a poignant way. Battlestar Galactica, there's no sound in space. What you get is the sound of the bullets echoing in the air that's in the cockpits of the Vipers. So it's this muffled kind of thing, which again gives it more of that submarine feel, which I think is again a great way to handle it. But like with Lost in Space. If they had gone super technical on it, then I don't know, because they didn't throw it so far in the future, I don't know that they would have been able to do it. The other thing that I think too, is that it doesn't necessarily get explained. And I love that the show does not explain everything to you and it doesn't beat you over the head with stuff. But as they encounter more things on this planet that are not like anything they've seen before, it's water in a glacier, but is it water? Like, is it exactly like the water on Earth, or is there something in it that makes it freeze faster or different? Like, that's the kind of thing that I can say, like, I don't know. I don't think they know, the Robinsons. Maybe the show knows, but it wasn't important, right? Like, I didn't need Maureen to give me an explanation as to why the water was freezing, right? Because then it would have felt like a CW show.
Yeah, right. I do like that she acknowledges, though, that it's like, you're asking me for a simple answer to something where there are far too many variables for me to just figure this out.
Yeah. I mean, and Star Trek, I find, in a good way, because I like that Star Trek, like, they're so far in the future that they press a button and the computer and the sensors kind of tell them almost everything they need to know right away. But with this, like, Maureen is trying to figure out where the hell they are, how the hell they're going to survive. Her husband is military, so he's got the practical survival down, but she's trying to figure out, like, how do we get off this rock? What kind of, like, is it safe to be here in the first place? Like, there's all the stuff that goes on. And she's using really, not rudimentary, but basic scientific ways of doing that. And she doesn't have all the variables, so she can't answer these questions. So a lot of the time she's like, I don't know. What I do know is that it's going to get very cold very fast, and that's as far as we get. Because if we don't survive the night, I don't have time tomorrow to figure out how to get off the planet. You know, like, it just, they prioritize. And I think that kind of hierarchy of needs is dictated because they have their three children with them, right? Like, it is protect the family and survive first. It is science second. Like, that's really what it comes down to, right? When they were going to Alpha Centauri, it was a new start for the family. It was get everybody settled, but then it was going to be all these opportunities to be and do whatever you want and do all this research and be the some of the first families in space. But that all gets flipped when you're now going, like, base needs, food, survival, warmth, shelter, then we can decide, okay, what's the next mission? Like, what is the next priority to try and get off the planet or, fix whatever is happening. I think it early on in either episode one or episode two, I can't remember what it was, but there's a fuel issue. So that becomes the focus. Like, it's not, we have to get out of where we are and get to a safe place. It's like, well, if this fuel issue isn't solved, we're not going anywhere. So that then becomes priority. And I think they do a really good job of balancing the grand, romantic idea of exploring space and doing all this cool science stuff with, like, no, we have to make sure we don't die in the meantime.
Yeah. And like you were saying, with the fact that you've got a scientist mother and a husband, a father with a military background, that's what the general population is like as well. And so you have joined that whole, we need to get this fuel, very different mindsets, where you've got some people who, it becomes ethical and moral dilemmas when somebody's injured. And, do we help the injured person or do we focus on the fuel?
Right.
And it's the need, you know, the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many, or the opposite, depending on your, you know, your personal train of thought. And it really kind of explores that, because to some degree, both answers are right.
Yeah.
But where do you morally stand?
Yeah. And how do you, and how do you,
how
make,
do you
that,
make that decision?
How do you make that decision as a person, as part of a community? And then how do you make that decision as a father, you know, or a mother? Very early on in the first episode, there's a moment where Will and his dad have to go exploring, and John has to turn back to help the family, but he's not with Will, but he establishes that Will is okay, as in not hurt, but alone on a strange planet, and he has to leave, you know, like, and this is all within the first, you know, 20 minutes of the first episode. And so you're like, wow. Like, it feels almost cold, but like you can see the decision being made and been like, you can see him say shit, like in his head. He doesn't swear, but you can see him say like, God damn, like this kid is going to hate me for the rest of his life, but I gotta go. Like it really is this constant seesaw of like, just when you think they've got one problem sorted, then another problem comes up that means that they have to potentially create a third problem to solve the first. You know, like it's just, you know, and it taxes everybody involved. Like the longstanding effects of all of the events that happened in the first two episodes, I think, really last the season almost in terms of how it affects the family. I don't really have any other general comments to make other than I highly recommend it for people that like sci-fi. If you like Star Trek, if you like Star Wars, if you like Firefly, this is absolutely your show. And I would highly recommend checking it out. Do you have any other kind of broad feedback on the show?
I think one of the things for me, that being somebody who grew up with the original and with the movie, one of the things that appears very, very early on is that basically one of the antagonists, Dr. Smith, is very different in this show.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's not really Dr. Smith. They have an attack, and the real Dr. Smith is injured, and he's actually played by the actor who played Will Robinson in the original 60s show.
Oh, is it really? I didn't know that.
He's a cameo, yeah. So when I saw him, I was like, no way.
That's
and
really cool.
I only recognized him because he's also in Babylon 5.
Oh. Okay.
So I know from like Babylon 5, he was the kid from Lost in Space, and here he is now doing a cameo here. And Parker Posey is playing a character who ends up stealing his jacket and then takes on that mantle of Dr. Smith. And so for me, I'm watching this going, it is Dr. Smith in a way, because she's taking on that role.
Right.
But it's still a very different way of doing it.
Yeah.
So I think even for people who've seen the original and have seen the movie, and it's kind of like, well, we've had the same thing here, there's still a lot of intrigue as to, but this is different, and why?
Yes, yeah. I think even people that have seen both the original series and the 90s movie would still get an awful lot from this. Potentially even absolutely. More, I would say. And again, before we get into spoiler territory, I will say that the cast was very well chosen, and the acting in the show is really top-notch. For television series for Netflix, I really think for the most part it is really, really well done. So from that point we can get into some spoilers. So if you have not finished the show, I don't want to start dancing around as to when we talk about stuff. So Alistair and I are going to get into some spoilers. We might be talking about the last episode first. We might be talking about the middle. So just if you haven't seen it, tune out, come back a little bit later and check it out. But I can tell you one thing that I didn't like. So now that we're past the spoilering point, I really did not like Dr. Smith. And I can't for the life of me tell you if it's because Parker Posey did a fantastic job playing a despicable person. So you just seethe whenever she's on screen. Mm-hmm. Like you just... Because you know everything, and then none of the other characters do until later on. So you know that she is just up to no good at every minute of every day. And you just...
She's very underhanded.
And you love the Robinsons, so you get very protective. You're like, you stay away from them. Like, you just... get... But the other thing that rubs me the wrong way which is the complete opposite opinion, is that I don't really like Parker Posey as an actor. I don't think she's very good. Probably a better actor than I am, but I don't enjoy her work. And I find that the lines that she delivers and the things that she's doing are so unconvincing that you're wondering why an astrophysicist, a very sharp military man, and a bunch of really smart kids don't put it together sooner. Like, nothing that she says sounds believable as an acting line. So then I'm wondering, how the hell, outside of the script says so, does Maureen not see it sooner? And that always bugged me the whole time. It's just like, I don't believe for a second that Parker Posey is delivering any kind of believable line. I feel like, and this is, it gets a little bit meta. I feel like, I can't remember her character's name. She plays Dr. Smith. What's the character's actual real name? They have it dotted out in IMDb. What's that? Dr. Smith is her stolen identity, but she has a real name. Yeah,
June Harris.
June Harris.
Yeah, June Harris.
June Harris is supposed to be a professional con artist. And because the lines are delivered so poorly, you're like, that is the most see-through con line I have ever seen in a movie, right? Like, give me any other crime, you know, movie like Ocean's 11 and like all that kind of stuff where these people are shysters and really good at what they do. And they fool even you, the audience, until there's a reveal later. And I really wish they had gone that way with Parker Posey, because I didn't believe for a minute that June Harris was capable of impersonating Dr. Smith.
Yeah. I think that for a lot of it, I think there's a lot of different reasons behind it.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that she, as in Parker Posey, is playing character, like she plays it a lot like she's done a lot of her comedy characters.
Yeah.
And so there are times when I'm just kind of expecting almost a comedic punchline. I mean, there are times where she does have those, but even on the more serious, more devious ones, I'm still kind of feeling like it's coming from a comedy, even though that's not what the show is. So there's a little bit of a mismatch there.
Yeah.
The other thing is that she is, and I was reading about this not too long ago, it turns out she's a huge fan of the original series. She actually grew up watching it. And Dr. Smith is a little bit more like that. He's, the actor who played him was quite theatrical himself, especially with how he delivered the lines. And he even got to a point where he ended up writing his own lines for the show. And, you know, and really nobody would, you know, stop doing it. They liked what he was doing. He went from this very sinister to something a bit more comedic, but the actor himself was doing that. And so he was quite flamboyant in a way in certain elements. And I think that because she grew up as such a huge fan of the character and suddenly being able to play this role herself, I think there is a little bit of her trying to pay homage to that.
Mm.
But also perhaps there's too much, fan service that she's doing for herself.
Maybe.
And I don't know if that's clouding some of her performance. I'm not sure.
It's inconsistent. Like, and that's the thing. And those inconsistencies to me are the things that, if I'm looking at her through the eyes of the Robinsons, those inconsistencies are the red flags where I go, that doesn't make any sense. Like, who, like, how are you who you say you are, sort of stuff. Especially when they get into mixed company. And, like, there's other characters that show up as they find the other Jupiters and the cast grows. I feel like while they were able to maybe convince me that she was fooling the Robinsons, I was like, there is no way that she's going to be able to pull this off for the entirety of the season. And eventually they do find her out. Like, I mean, eventually they do find her out. And that was, I think, one of the more disappointing things, is that as smart as all these people are, including the kids, I really felt like they had a great they had a moment when Maureen put Dr. Smith in the cargo hold. It was one of the last episodes. Mm. But then Will eventually lets her out. And
that is a staple of the show, though.
Yeah, and that's fine.
The original, yeah, because he was manipulated in there, he was manipulated in the movie, and he was manipulated in this as well. So they kind of kept that as a staple of...
Yeah, the issue with that in terms of, you know, you talked about earlier about sticking to their own rules, Will is smart enough to not fall for that. Mm. I know what she said to him. I know she said the robot should be going up in space, not your dad. But it's the combination of, we've all already established how smart Will is. He's already made some very tough decisions to support his family. And she's telling him to go back on those decisions, to not listen to his folks that said, we're not supposed to talk to you. We're not supposed to let you out. And then when she says it, she drops into this weird, like, I'm talking to a 5-year-old voice. That's just like, I've seen Will and his father have adult conversations. The parents don't talk down to their kids. It is phenomenal. It's a great aspect of the show. And I just feel like nothing in the way that they portrayed that really made sense to me in terms of all the information that I had from the previous 7 or 8 episodes. So that to me was kind of a weak point of her arc. I would have preferred that Joan Harris be a little bit more resourceful, maybe be able to escape herself. You know, maybe she's got, she snuck a, you know, not a screwdriver, but, you know, maybe she was able to somehow get free. But because I think it also undermines how smart Maureen is and how much you root for Maureen Robinson when she finally gets Dr. Smith into the cargo hold. You're like, yes, you know, like you that's a cheering moment as an audience member, right? So
absolutely,
you know, so you're, and then just like half an episode later, or not even, she's out again. She's like, oh damn it. Like, so, and stuff like that. And I think that by that point, which may be the strength of the film versus a series, is that you get really tired of Dr. Robinson after about 10 episodes. You're like, really, is this still going on? So I'm curious now how that's going to pan out in the next season, provided that they make one. I haven't looked up to see if they're going to. I'm assuming they're going to, because there's been more good reviews than bad, I think, of Lost in Space.
I think the way that they've done it, I think they... I just can't see them not making a second season. I really can't see them not doing that.
I mean, Netflix is just printing new series. My gosh. Every time I turn around, there's 3 or 4 new things from all different walks. Like, it's comedy this, or documentary that, or film here, series there, and it's all over different subject matters and stuff like that. So they've definitely got the resources, I think, to do it. I'd love to see them do it.
They've also ended the series at the point where, you know, that is the basis of the show, which is, it's one family stranded. And this was one of the things that pulled me in right at the beginning, was, wait, it's not one family?
Right, yeah.
There's a bunch of them. It's not just the one ship. There's a whole fleet of them.
Yeah.
And then you've got the big ship that's sort of taken them there. I forgot, the Resolute that's taken them there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was amazing that there was all these different people, and you almost had a community. To some extent, it ended up being like J.J. Abrams' series Lost, but set in space.
Right.
At a little point, and I was a little bit worried, like, is that where they're going to go with it? But
yeah, I was when the cast expanded, I was a little concerned that it was going to get, oh God, they're going to be on this planet forever, and it's going to be Lost, or it's going to be what's that CW show, The 100, where they're all stranded on the planet. Same idea, you know, like it becomes Lord of the Flies instead of Lost in Space.
Yeah, but and Lost in Space was them kind of landing on a different planet each week and stuff. And so I like that at the end, they suddenly get separated from the Resolute, and they are now themselves actually lost.
Completely. In space, yeah. And they handled, how I, you know, what I talked about earlier about, like, you know, not throwing it too far into the future really, really well, where the unknown that you get to find out much, much later is that the robot attacked the Resolute and crashed it because it was trying to retrieve an engine that humankind had that should not have had. Like, it's not that we developed space travel and that we were getting ourselves off the planet. It's that we found something that crashed to the planet, and that's how we were getting ourselves out there. We found, like, an engine that allowed us to do space travel. And
we stole it. We cheated.
Yeah.
And they want it back.
Yeah.
And that gives them far more credibility than we have.
Yeah.
You know, as a species, it's like, they're attacking the Resolute, but at the same time, they're well within their rights, because what did we do to them?
Right.
Um,
yeah. I mean, the comet that they talk about, the entire series that crashed, the Christmas comet that crashed into the planet and caused all this turmoil. And again, like, they don't over explain it, but you can kind of connect the dots in terms of like the environmental effects of a large comet hitting the planet and then the political fallout of warring over the resources. And so Earth is a shit show.
And it's not quite the asteroid that killed out the dinosaurs, but no, it's close to.
Causes
it's,
a problem,
it's caused
right?
enough to cause a climate problem.
Exactly. And but then they reveal that it wasn't a comet, that it was a spaceship, and that's where they got this engine thing. In a very, very clever way. And I feel real science fiction, where like this thing is sprouting technical roots like a plant and controlling the ship. Like, now you don't really have to tell me like, well, the water didn't freeze the way that it was supposed to in the first episode. Like, yeah, okay, explain this, smartass. Like, what are the physics behind that? And I think that's where I really like it, is that there's the humanity, the Robinsons and their interaction with technology is very much close to home in terms of their science knowledge. But then what's happening around them now is real good science fiction. Like, it's really out there. But the show doesn't really let you know that right away, right? And I think I think that's why people criticize it so harshly at the beginning. I'm curious. Dad liked it overall. Like, he finished the whole thing and went through and watched it. So it didn't the little bits like that he caught didn't seem to really bother him, to the point where he wouldn't watch the show. I need to touch base with some other people that had the same opinions about the first couple episodes and see whether they warmed up to it and just kind of forgave it, right? Because some of the biggest shows that have the biggest following have got some terrible logic behind them. You know, I mean, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer is a huge show, and I've never liked it. You know, like, it just, you know, there's people that are fans of things tend to forgive, you know, the little inconsistencies or the little grievances, you know, that come up. But no, I like the dynamic. I really enjoy, as you get to know the kids and get to know their relationship with one another. I love the relationship with the parents and how they resolve that. Cause you get concerned like, oh God, like he was away in the military. Why are they estranged? Like, what happened? And instead of something typical, like he or she cheats, you know, or they've made promises that they don't keep, they make a reveal that really affects your opinion of John for the better. He volunteers to go back to the military with all the trouble that happens on Earth after the comet hits. So he wasn't told to go. He tells his wife that he was told to go, but then he volunteered. So it's his sense of duty that is the reason why his marriage falls apart. And I really thought that was an excellent way to handle that. Like, well, because it's not typical, and if he had done anything else, then he would have dropped a notch on your opinion, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, like, the kids as well just seem so much more grounded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really enjoyed Mina Sundwall. She played Penny, the middle kid. She's hilarious.
And the thing is as well is that I can't really remember what Penny was like in the original series, but certainly in the movie she was very hyper. You know, whereas I just felt that the Penny in this series was just a lot more believable, especially for someone her age.
Yeah, and...
And like her kind of motivations behind everything.
Yeah, and all the kids are brave and scared at the same time. It's really well done, where like she's jumping into a chariot. I want one, by the way. She's jumping into a chariot, which is essentially like a glorified, you know, rover, to go rescue her parents from a storm that she sees coming, but they don't see coming because they're in a valley doing something. I can't remember what. And so she's out in this thing without a driver's license. So she's driving for the first time, getting to know all this kind of stuff. And she's smart, so she's getting with it. But then it, like, you know, starts raining stones or something crazy. And she's like, yeah, so I'm driving down a cliff to rescue my family in a, you know, rock storm. Yep, that's happening. And you can tell that she's like talking herself through the fear with sarcasm. Mm. It's very, very well done. Like, she's talking to herself. There's no one else in the car with her. Like, it just, I really enjoyed a lot of what she did. And I'm glad that she ends up having a crush on a boy later on in the series.
Yeah.
And yeah. I was concerned, again, because that's around the same time where you feel like, oh God, is this going to turn into Dawson's Creek on Planet X, you know, like, because you're like, oh God, like, is this, I don't want this to be a Planet sitcom, right? But they don't do that. They try it. It happens naturally. And then they both have to say, well, their family and getting off this rock is a priority. So we kind of have to, you know, they do it like teenagers. Like, they don't necessarily handle it like adults, but it doesn't pan out, and it doesn't pan out in for the right reasons. You know, like, it is, I like the way that they handle it.
I was kind of rooting for them, and when it doesn't happen. But the other thing as well is that it also serves as a good backdrop to really show how terrified she really is.
Yeah.
She's not showing how scared she is, but she finds out after overhearing her parents that the planet's going to be destroyed.
Right.
And she kind of plans everything out for this romantic thing with him, yeah, that they were going to be in the pool. She would pretend to be, yeah, in trouble and get rescued. And she kind of planned everything out because she's like, I need this because we're probably going to die. And if I die and I've not been with a boy, then,
yeah,
you know, and it really kind of highlighted that, especially when things don't pan out the way that she wanted. And she does freak out quite a lot.
Yeah. And I like the fact too, that she's smart enough to know that that's not how things work, but because she's a literary freak. Like, she reads constantly. So she's setting up this romantic story that she's kind of cobbled together from all the novels that she's read, is like, this is how romance works, right? Like, I don't know, because we're all science nerds, so, and none of us have dated. So, like, this is all new ground to me. So I'm going to go with the only thing I know, which is the romantic novel stories that I've read. And so she tries to recreate that. Yeah, no, I really enjoyed a lot of how they wrote Penny. I thought that was really good. And same with Molly Parker. I there's a lot of really strong female characters in this show. And what's so nice about it is that they don't smack you in the face with it. Mm. Like, they never once talk about, the characters don't talk about, like, girl power or, you know, all the kind of stuff. There's just this balance. Like, there's just this balance across all the characters and all the families of, like, there's guys and girls doing guys and girls jobs, and they all just have duties and knowledge. They're all smart. Like, everybody is on this even playing field. They have different specialties, but they're all in this even playing field. If anything, the only thing that I think that strikes an imbalance is age. You know, like, Will Robinson isn't able to defend himself. Like, there's a conversation where he has with his dad about after he's, like, been tied up, and he's like, can you show me how to punch somebody so I don't have to be tied up again? Thanks. Like, you know, because he's 10, you know, like, he just, or 11. And I think that that's the only disadvantage. Like, it's the size and stature, you know, and age of some people, and having to listen to their parents and those kind of things. Those are the only drawbacks. There's no lines between the sexes in terms of duty or quality of performance or anything like that. It's a really, really well handled show in that realm. I really enjoyed Judy Robinson too, the smart-ass older daughter.
Yeah, and the one person that we haven't spoken about, and Judy kind of leads into it, is Don West.
Yes, I really liked him.
I did, and especially as, again, completely different from the original show and movie. If anything, he's probably the person most furthest removed.
Okay, so I didn't realize that. I figured that everybody off of the original five or six people would have been just made up for the show, but Don West is from the original series?
Yeah, so then the original, he was the pilot.
Oh.
So he was brought in, you know, to control the ship should something go wrong with the ship. One of his lines was something along the lines of, if you wake up and I'm flying the ship, something bad has happened.
Right.
And he's the character that Matt LeBlanc plays in the movie. And in that movie, he basically just plays, he's really playing Joey, but with far more testosterone.
Okay.
in all honesty. But in this one, he's not the pilot. He's an engineer, and he's kind of a roughneck kind of guy smuggling a load of stuff. He's not a good person. And Judy changes him in a way.
Yeah.
In fact, I like how quickly Judy realizes how she can manipulate him just with a simple look.
Yeah.
and he makes a good point, though, that there are times when he's learning that really he should do the right thing. But doing the right thing never goes well for him.
No.
And he almost kind of goes back to, but I do the wrong thing, but I benefit more from it.
Yeah.
One thing that I find absolutely adorable, and again, this was more, it was partly, I think, to show a bit of his character that there is still good in him, so that you can at least admire him at the very beginning when you first meet him. But also, I think, is really good fan service to people from the original, is his chicken. His chicken, Debbie.
Yeah.
So in the original series, Debbie was a monkey that they found on a planet. Or it's like an alien that looks like a monkey. In the 90s movie, it's a CGI-type alien monkey kind of thing, mm-hmm. That they call Bloop or Blarp or something like that. But they went back to using the name Debbie, but instead of having like a monkey, they just have a chicken.
Right.
Just a regular homegrown earth chicken. And just the fact that he saves this one chicken and keeps it as a pet. And he's very clear that when he goes away that he wants it to be looked after.
Yeah.
I think is quite respectable.
Yeah. And they do a lot of little character nods like that. I was concerned for a little while that there was going to be a romance between Judy and Don.
I'm just kind of touching on it, but
I'm not 100% sure they're past that. But to me, they did a pretty good job of inching it a little bit more towards a younger sister he wants to impress.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Because there's a huge age difference there, and you don't necessarily, like you said, you don't like Don right away. And if he had eyes for Judy, you'd have been like, you stay away from Judy, buddy. there would have been some of that.
You
there
become the protective older brother or sister.
Yeah, exactly, right? But that's how I sort of feel that he's starting to be. Like, there's some moments where when Judy loses a patient in one of the accidents that happens when they're trying to retrieve from some fuel, guy gets crushed and he eventually dies. There's some subtle moments where she's like, I have to now, because, you know, I'm doing the doctor thing, I now have to go inform his family that this guy has died. And Don just says, like, I'll drive you. But it's the way that they exchange those lines. He's not doing that out of any kind of, like, trying to impress her in a romantic way. Like, he's doing that because it's the right thing to do. And it's the kind of thing that family would do for you. Like, I have to go to this really, really hard thing. I'll drive you, you know, as the older brother or the sibling, the aunt or uncle might do if you had like a really close relationship with them. And I think that kind of nudged me away from thinking that they were going romantic with it and more of a platonic kind of brother sister thing. Well, and especially because Judy is the oldest sibling, so she doesn't have an older brother. And I kind of like the way that they kind of make Dawn that role for her. Because, I mean,
it's also a very...
So go ahead.
It's also a very modern way of approaching it as well, because the original series really made things kind of stereotypically sexist regarding that. Because there's actually a video, and I sent it to Megan not too long ago. It was like a network sales presentation that the network had made to try and sell the show back in the 60s. And it has a scene where it's kind of showing Judy, and it's like, you know, we've got Judy and she has a problem that all teenagers can relate to. What will she do for boyfriends? Well, there's an answer for that. Major Don West. You know, and that was really almost the entire purpose and storyline for her was her her and Don ending up together, really.
Yeah.
In the movie, they kind of start to get together by the end, but for the most part, it's Matt LeBlanc trying to impress Heather Graham and Heather Graham just having none of it and pouring water over his head and stuff.
Right.
Whereas now we've kind of got to a point where it's, as you say, like, it's not just a, you know, straight out flirtation. It's
there's
you know,
more
it's,
to it's it.
Kind of
and
like
I
realistic,
hope, yeah. Yeah, I hope they go the high road on that. Like, I don't want them to go for an easy kind of relationship there. Mm. Well, because now they're down to like, because if this is how this rolls, then they're down to like the core cast, right? Like, there's no extension now. Everybody that's on that ship is what's left.
Yeah. So we've got the, I think, seven of them. So five. Yeah. Dr. Smith, Don West. You've got the robot and possibly Debbie, the chicken. I don't know if she's
I think so.
Still on board.
I think so.
Yeah. But that literally becomes it.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah. I wasn't overly convinced about the way that the robot flip-flopped at the end. That to me was weird. I didn't like the fact that the robot flipped and was protecting Dr. Smith when she rebuilt it. Like, that to me was weak sauce. With the robot back on Will's side at the very, very end, I kind of just, I can forget the whole Dr. Smith flip-flop with the robot. I'm just like, forget it. I'll just pretend like the robot was Will's the whole time because it makes more sense that way. The one thing that, the only other criticism before we leave and move on is that I understand for budgetary reasons they had to go to a costume, but I was really disappointed that we didn't have like a CG robot the whole time.
Part of me agrees. At first it was just like, great, so we've got a man in a suit with a little bit of CGI there. Mm-hmm. As time went on, there was two things that kind of stood out to me. One, it places it a lot more realistically in the frame. You know, we're so used to seeing CG, there was actually became something nice about seeing something physical mm-hmm. there.
Yeah,
to me.
Yeah.
I also like that he isn't humanoid in appearance at first. He deliberately morphs himself to be like that. And from the looks of it, he's not designed to be assembled that way. He kind of looks at Will and tries to make something more akin to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that I thought was kind of cool. I don't really want to spoil the 90s movies too much, but there is a character that appears in the final act that looks very similar in build to how the robot is when you first see him.
Right.
And I feel that that's kind of where they drew on that for his more alien look for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I liked it. It threw me off at first, but as the more time went on, it was just like, no, you know what? I actually like that there's something real and physical there.
I get the practicality of it, especially because of the relationship with Will and the robot and how much interaction physically they have to have. Like, he hugs it, he hangs out with it, he plays catch with it. Like, I mean, I understand that they had to kind of go that way. And I also get how complicated it would be technically to have a CG character in almost every scene, you know, with Will for the duration of the series. Like, I get that.
I felt a lot more emotion from it as well when the robot mimics Will in just raising his hands up in the air celebration.
Yeah, there are some cool character moments in that way too. But I think that they remind you of how cool it looks when it goes into battle mode, when it has to defend the camp from the weird lizard thing that attacks them. And he tells it to go bad, and it goes bad, and it, you know, it could really quickly handle everything else. And I just kind of wish they had done just a little bit more. I really felt like the movement on the, I think what got me, all the character and subtle moments were great. It was just whenever the thing was walking around that I was like, wow, that is really stiff. Like, that, considering all the high tech stuff that you know it can do and all the high tech stuff that you've seen in the series so far, this really jilted actor walking around in a suit didn't really sell it to me. But it's a small grievance that you get reminded of when you watch it walk by, and then you forget about it when there's a character moment and stuff like that. But that would be my only real, you know, criticism left on the show. But that's it for me.
I was just as one final thing, I would just be really interested to hear what somebody who actually grew up watching the original series back in the 60s it was airing would feel, given that the original was a man in a suit.
Yeah.
To see if they would still accept a man in a suit, or whether they would be kind of feeling the same, that like CGI would be the way to go.
Yeah. I'll talk to my dad.
Excellent. Yeah. Let me know.
Well, that rolls us into the Internet Minute, which is brought to you by you. As a matter of fact, you can go to patreon.com/thecitadelcafe. It's one of the best ways to support the show. You can become a patron there. It's completely up to you. If you do that, then you can join us in the Discord, which is a small community of people that are supporting the Citadel Cafe. We hang out. We talk about Lego. We talk about Minecraft. We do all kinds of fun stuff in there. Talk about things like this on the show. So if you'd like to do that, head on over to patreon.com/thecitadelcafe. and I thank you very, very much. My internet minute this week is actually Minecraft related. I stumbled upon this after following a couple of videos by a YouTuber named Corrales. He does a lot of Minecraft stuff, but he did this series of inspiration where he's going into different servers and looking at different builds, and sometimes he gets to talk to the people that build them. But this one particular episode, which is like 40 minutes long and worth every second, is the mcmiddleearth.com community. It's a build site for Minecraft, is recreating Middle Earth in Minecraft. And for the most part, it's to scale to the best of their abilities. They're basing it off of maps and the literature, not so much the movies. The look of things, I think they're basing off the movies just because the movies got a lot of that feel right. But you can log in to the server. You can walk around yourself. The server makes available tour guides if you want to do that. And this video by Corrales, he is taken with a bunch of his friends and they tour the server. And they use a function called teleport, which is native to Minecraft, to move around and see the different locations. Because they're saying, like, you know, it takes 4 hours to walk from Bree or from Hobbiton to Rivendell in-game. Like, if you just actually physically walk it, it takes that long. Because Minecraft is built on a real scale, each block is supposed to be 1 by 1 meter. I don't think it's quite to scale in terms of how it was supposed to be in Lord of the Rings, because when I went in and I walked, I did a little bit of flying, but I walked mostly from the Shire in Hobbiton to Bree, and it really only took me about an hour and a half. And I was also being distracted by things and looking at builds and checking stuff out. So there's some stuff there. I'm not really sure about the scale in that regards, but when you're standing in front of a build, when you're standing in front of Bag End, or if you're standing in front of the Prancing Pony and you go inside, it definitely feels to be about the right scale for you, the player, whether you're supposed to be a hobbit or whether you're supposed to be human size or whatever. Like, it tends to work pretty well. To give you a sense of the scale of some of the builds, Minecraft normally has a 256 block or 256 meter build limit, and that's from bedrock all the way up to the sky limit. Most of the time, the earth that you're standing on is somewhere around Y level 60. When they built Isengard, they actually, there's nothing underneath Isengard. You're standing on like Y equals 11 or 12 when you're standing on the grass at the base of Isengard. And the tower goes the full build limit from floor to ceiling. It is phenomenal. The amount of detail and the attention to detail is out there. It's almost impossible to describe. There's a dynamic map that you can check out on mcmiddleearth.com. And you can zoom in a little bit to the point where you can kind of get an idea of just how big this map is and just how much stuff they've built. A lot of stuff that's not even touched on in the films, but it's part of the Tolkien universe. These are a bunch of people that are very into Tolkien, very into Middle Earth. And like, it is just mind blowing. And you can walk around yourself. Like, it's not just a video that you can go watch. You can actually log on and walk around. And it is an extraordinary experience. As a Minecraft player, to check out what the work that these people have done over 6 years or something crazy. Have you heard about this before, Alistair?
I hadn't until you kind of linked to it. I mean, I've seen other Minecraft related things like that. Like, there is actually a one called Mine Trek, which is all Star Trek related,
right?
Where they have tons of ships built and it's just insane. But yeah, I've never even sort of heard of it until you brought it up in the Discord.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth checking out. One of the cool features about it, when you log into the server, it's totally free. You can just walk around. They give you a role, like, it's a very controlled space. Like, you are an adventurer, and you basically can't do anything but walk around and look at stuff. Well, you can fly. Like, it's a creative server, so you have those kind of controls. But you don't have an inventory. You can't place blocks. You can't do anything like that.
And you wouldn't want people to grief everything anyway.
Exactly. But one of the things that they do, which I think is really, really smart, they've got some coding and stuff that's happening behind the scenes where you have to open up the chat window and there's clickable text in the chat window that takes you through a quiz. So you get to walk through this cave that is decorated in twists and turns, and there's all these cool torches and things, and you're trying to get out of this cave so you can get to the Shire, which of course is a really cool thing. That's what you want to see. But at every so often they stop you and they ask you a question, and you have to go read the new player guide and the FAQ on their website in order to answer this question. And they're quizzing you about their rules and regulations. They're quizzing you about policies and what you can and cannot do, you know, while you're on the server, how you're supposed to behave, all that kind of stuff. It is a very smart way to, I don't want to say force, but really encourage people to read through the terms of services and make sure that you understand how much work has gone into this, how little tolerance they have for people that want to mess it up, and how, but they also balance that with a, because it's not harsh language, they balance that with the amount of fun and how cool it is going to be for you to get through this quiz and get to the other side. And I think it's a really smart way of just like creating a very small gate to their community, but just saying like, look, this is not for all you people that really want to be here and check it out and think it's cool. We know that 90% of you are going to be really, really cool people to come and enjoy the server, but it's the internet and we have to be prepared for the knuckleheads out there that want to come in and cause trouble. And we have to be very clear for those people. So bear with us. It'll be worth it and go through this process.
It was
fun. The quiz was actually fun. They took something that felt a little bit like a hurdle at first because you're excited, but by the time you're done, you're like, nope, that was worth it. I get it now.
It almost sounds like old school copy protection, where they kind of like turn to page 63, line 4, word 2.
Yeah, exactly.
In the manual. And what is that word?
Yeah.
And you may now proceed.
Yeah.
It almost comes across a little bit like that. Like you have to go to the FAQ before you can go any further.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
but
some
it
of
works,
the
from the sounds of it.
And one of the things that they were very clear about, which is smart, is that they say like, can you make videos about Minecraft Middle Earth and put it on your YouTube channel? Like they kind of make it sound like you can't, but when you review their terms and services, you can. You just have to make sure that you link to the website, that you give the proper accreditation, and that you're respecting and portraying it in a way that you're not pretending to be a part of it. You're just saying like, holy crap, these people have made this. Look how cool it is, essentially. It's smart because, I mean, like the more people that get out there and share it, then the more it gets known and the more support that the server gets. Because they don't try to make any money with it. They just are a break-even community where they just try to raise the amount of money needed per month to keep the server up and running. And I can only imagine with the amount of building, the amount of people and the sheer size of this thing that they probably have a pretty hefty server to keep this rolling. So that is at mcmiddleearth.com. And be sure to check out the map that they have linked there as well. I think it's really, really cool. What is your pick this week, sir?
Mine is Stage 9, and it's very similar to everything that you've just described. But rather than being Minecraft, it's the entire USS Enterprise D rebuilt in Unreal Engine 4. And it is incredible. It's a community of people, just kind of like with the Middle Earth thing, just all working together to build this incredible ship. And what they're doing is they're trying not only to show you realistically all of the different places that you've seen before, they're also trying to show you stuff that have been part of the blueprints for decades now that have never been seen on screen.
Right.
So you've got the bridge and you've got the observation lounge. There's a corridor between them and it's always been in the blueprints, but it's never been seen on TV. They go off the bridge and then they appear in that, you know, and so now you can actually walk there. But just the scale of it is all to scale. You can get in a shuttle and you can fly like seamlessly walk into the shuttle, fly out of the shuttle bay, and then fly around the ship. The entire thing is completely seamless. You can then beam back onto the ship, go to the bridge. You can then set a course and warp to Deep Space Nine and dock at Deep Space Nine.
Wow.
And it's astounding. And the technical stuff that they've come up with, I mean, when you think about when people make a game, it's usually done over a relatively short period, still a long time, but these guys have been working on this for years, and it really shows. And this is all people in their spare time.
Mm-hmm.
this is all non-profit. They do allow people to donate, and that again will just be for server maintenance. They legally cannot make a penny off it.
Right. That's probably where the Minecraft server is as well. Like, you know, with Warner Brothers and everything else in there now.
Yeah. Exactly. But I mean, they do things like, as you're walking around, if you walk through the doors to something, then it loads that room. As you walk out, it unloads the room. And they do some amazing videos on YouTube where they talk about how they built it. And they were thinking, well, you could go into a turbo lift and then you can just have it appear out where, you know, where you want to arrive. No, they built the entire turbo lift network. So as you're going around the ship, you're actually, it's taking you that exact amount of time because your turbo lift is actually moving through the ship.
Wow.
And to top it all off, for anybody who's lucky enough to have an HTC Vive or an Oculus Rift,
whoa,
they've built it for virtual reality.
Wow. That would be really cool.
It is astonishing. So that's stage-9.co.uk. And if you just check out the videos that they post up on YouTube as well, or look at the sort of gallery that people have submitted, it is just incredible what they've managed to achieve. And when you download it and play, just the sheer scale of how big everything is and how seamless you move from area to area, it's mind-boggling and unlike anything I've ever seen.
Very, very cool. We'll have a link to that, as well as the Minecraft Middle-Earth server, in the show notes for this week. But that's it. That brings us to the end of this episode of The Citadel Cafe. You can find all that stuff at thecitadelcafe.com. You can email the show at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com and let us know what you thought of Lost in Space. Find us by name on Twitter and Facebook, and of course, leave us a review on iTunes. It's one of the best ways for the show to get new listeners. You can also just tell friends about it. It's also a lot easier than even using iTunes, because iTunes makes it really hard to find ratings and stuff, I find. And it matters too what country you're in. So just tell a friend about the show. It's my mission for you this week, should you decide to accept it. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am doing online at joelduggan.com or my name on most social media outlets. Currently, we are ramping up a new set of prints in the Forge Publishing shop. If you've been following Piper's work, she's been doing tea historic dinosaurs, where she's been painting dinosaurs as teapots and tea paraphernalia. They're beautiful. They are really cute, and they're very, very pretty. We're putting together not one, but two print packs of these dino prints. And I think that people are really going to be excited to check them out. We also have a promo in the store right now where if you buy a book, you get a free print, and it's a free cherry blossoms print where she's got a bunch of little possums hanging upside down that look like cherry blossoms. So there's all kinds of really stuff going on, cool stuff going on at forgepublishing.com. And last but not least, check out my other podcast, Comics Coast to Coast. We took a week off this week. I was sick, as well as we had some trouble scheduling a guest, but we're back to interviewing some artists starting next week. So check that out as well. That's at comicscoasttocoast.com. Alistair, where can people find you and all the cool stuff that you were doing online?
So on Twitter, I'm at iMcFly, and my website is ohmyzod.com, which is where I post retrospectives of movies, so not reviews, because those are a dime a dozen everywhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
But more just kind of my personal feelings about movies and kind of how they hold up today.
I really enjoyed your piece about Roger Rabbit. I think people should go check that out. If you're at all a Roger Rabbit fan, then check that out. You've been listening to The Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two.